I'm Laura Vinroot Poole. For 20 years, I've owned Capital, an internationally recognized specialty store. Capital has never really been about fashion. It's always been about people. What we wore was created to share the meaningful journeys that inspire me. From the designers and friends I meet on the road to the men and women with whom I work each day.
Everybody wants to know her name.
I was thrilled to sit down with actress and friend Jessica Capshaw. In our conversation, Jessica shares her journey from the challenges of breaking into television as a young actress to her profound role as Dr. Arizona Robbins on Grey's Anatomy, the first openly gay series regular on network television. I loved hearing more about the entertainment industry and how Jess navigates it so beautifully as a working mother of four. Jessica Capshaw, I'm so excited to have you here.
I'm so happy to be here.
We met at the Country Mart, and I think you're basically the mayor of the Brentwood Country Mart.
The mayoress. What is the?
It's just mayor.
Yeah. I enjoy the Country Mart.
But isn't it like the happiest place in the world? It's something weird about that place. It's just really happy.
It makes me very happy.
Me too.
I think I sort of feel like it happened for me, or the relationship was cemented,
yes,
in the most durable of concretes when we bought a house, you know, probably within walking distance, like a 15-minute walk away from the mart. And I had had our first child, and it's such a walkable neighborhood.
Yeah.
And when you're a new mom, you're kind of like pretty sure there's a disaster around every corner, or that you should be able to be within 5 minutes of your house.
Yeah.
If meltdowns occur, yours or theirs. And so I started going to the mart because it was so close, and it was sort of like this, and it hadn't even fully rounded out to be like the most incredible, robust place that it is now. But I would go and I would grab a coffee, and I'd be able to sit with Luke, and we would, you know, walk and talk, and it was just sort of, it was so happy and sunny and open, and the floor plan sort of made you feel like wherever you were, there you were. You weren't super aware that there was so much more in the mart, like whatever store you're in, you really feel like you're in that place.
It's intimate.
Then 1 second later, you're around the corner and you've got some other world that you're walking into. And then, of course, as I had another and another and another child, it became the place that they were so familiar with.
Yeah.
That, you know, I always sort of say, truly, at 12, 9, 7, and 3, if I drop them off at the front door and I said, like, okay, go grab some breakfast, and then can you do me a couple errands,
then go to the shoe repair,
100% be able to come back and say, like, meet me at this spot, and they would have met me at that spot. They would have, you know, seen a couple friends, had a good time, gotten their stuff done. So it's like a big warm hug.
Tell me where you're from.
I was born in Columbia, Missouri. And my mom and my dad had met at Mizzou, the University of Missouri. They were both teachers. My mom was born in Texas originally, but then she moved to Missouri and sort of lived in Ferguson County, that Florissant area. Uh-huh. And my dad had been raised in a place called Chaffee, Missouri, which is about 2 hours south of St. Louis, and had been born into a family that there was no college, there was no nothing. And so my grandpa was very much like, by hook or by crook, you are going to college and you will all
become a professor.
Yeah, you will all either be lawyers or doctors. And so I guess my father bucked a little bit of convention and decided to become a teacher. But then he met my mom, because my mom also was friends with his sisters. So there were two boys and five girls in my dad's side of the family. And my mom was just enamored by this Capshaw family. Like, oh my gosh, these, like, my aunts were all, like, super beautiful. And, and I mean, it's always a lesson, and, like, you never know the whole story. But they seemed super glamorous, and they seemed to have it all. And meanwhile, they were, you know, born to parents who had nothing.
Yeah.
And it was so not... it was so not some sort of like fluent wealth or anything like that. It was not generational. It was all sort of brand new.
And what did they teach, your mom and your dad?
My mom taught basically what was called special ed.
My mom did that too.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And my mom was, you know, and still is, just a beautiful person inside and out. There was like one girl from two towns over that went to New York City and ended up landing herself on the cover of Seventeen magazine. Huh. And of course, as soon as someone that you actually know has done something, it actually becomes possible.
It's called an expander. We talk about it all the time.
Completely.
It is. Yes. It just opens your mind to realizing that you could do it.
That it's even possible.
Yeah.
But you know, that it's even an open, available thing.
I love that.
And so a bunch of her friends were said, you know, Kathy, you should go to New York City and you should see if you could be a model. And so Kathy had Bobby take some pictures in the backyard that are still in existence and quite
beautiful.
Amazing. And he took some pictures of her in the backyard. And then
Kathy's very glamorous. She's very beautiful.
Kathy's very glamorous. They went to New York City. My mom, I mean, the story goes that my mom and dad walked into Eileen Ford's modeling agency and had an appointment with her, I guess. And with the pictures my dad had taken, she signed her. And then they just decided to move to New York.
Wow.
Which is wild. I mean,
that is wild.
It's wild. So she was 23. She had me when she was 22 and I was about 2 or 3.
So you went with her?
Yeah.
Okay.
We all went.
And before we get to New York, how do you think Missouri formed you as a person?
Having been born there, I think that there's just sort of an innate identity that is rooted there. Mm-hmm. And then thankfully, my parents, not to skip ahead, but my parents got divorced.
Yeah.
And so when you're a young woman growing up with single parents, you know, I think your gender sort of on some level very much contributes to who you have the most, not affinity, but ease with.
Right.
And so that was my mom.
Yeah.
And so my dad was sort of, you know, a guy. And it was, again, sort of like a shared custody thing, but I wasn't with him all the time. And so there's this like little speed bump that you have with being able to like really identify with being with the parent who's the opposite gender and that you don't see all that often and everything else. And because he was so strongly tethered to his identity of being mm-hmm. from Missouri and being from a big family,
yeah,
we would spend most of the time that we had together back there, mm-hmm. which was amazing for me because I had 5 aunts and I had my cousins. So I ended up being in Missouri a lot. So
and I bet like those aunts were crazy about you.
Crazy about me. And by the way, it was like I was like a very strange, elaborate, and infinitely sympathetic character in that like no one had gotten divorced,
right?
So I was like this, you know, poor little Jessie,
right?
And so I mean, and I did not milk it, I swear, but I really did. Now that I look back on it, I mean, I just got treated like I was, you know,
yeah.
Everything was like, what can we do for you?
Yeah,
you poor little child. So I spent a ton of time with my grandma and my aunts, and then when my mom started working as an actress, there were like one of her first movies, she had to go to Chicago and she was gonna be working, you know, probably 12-16 hour days. And again, for the reasons I just outlined, I think I didn't want to stay in New York City with my dad
yeah.
full time. And so my grandma took me. So yeah. I went to Missouri and I lived in Chaffee with her for, you know, it seemed like I was there for a year, but I think looking back on it, it was probably like 2.5 months, something like that. But again, it was just sort of like who I was.
Your mother is still so Missouri also.
She is, I know.
Oh, she loves it. I mean, she talks about it.
I know.
Yeah. Tell me about growing up with her. She really is so glamorous inside and out, but such a lovely person. I want to hear about her style and kind of
and the evolution.
Yeah, because that's a big evolution,
yeah.
right?
Yeah. So my mom was just this very independent, very strong, but also very soft and very feminine mm-hmm. and nurturing and very maternal. Fun. We laughed so much. She always. And she still does, like, loves making fun of herself, loves making fun of situations. There's not a ton of ego there, you know? Back in the day, I feel like the first style that I really remember, and definitely I remember her putting her imprint on me, was, like, she, in New York City in those early days, she was very Annie Hall.
Mm-hmm. She still is.
She is. Yeah, she has. She still is. She was very Annie Hall, and then Annie Hall's daughter was Vera Laura Ashley. So I was very, like, in the sailor dresses
yeah.
and the sort of like
the
Little House on the Prairie vibe, yes, and the socks and I did go to a school with uniforms, so it was like I was either in like the uniform with the bobby socks and the shiny shoes and all that stuff, and the side pony, a half upside pony, or I was in the Laura Ashley.
The full Laura Ashley gear. Yes. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, I love that. How do you think her style influenced you?
I holistically loved her, so I think that it just became such a positive imprint. Like, all the things that she wore were just lovely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You grew up in New York and with your family in Missouri, back and forth. And then how did you get to L.A.? And when did you get to L.A.? And I'm sure your style changed a lot at that point.
Yes, it did. It completely did. You're making me think of it. And it did. So my mom, so she had started working in film. And then it sort of was like, she all of a sudden had like a very alive career.
Yeah.
And back then, a little more than even now, you would go on location. Like, you would go make the movie wherever the movie was meant to take place. So there was a lot of traveling. But she also had met and fallen in love with someone who lived in Los Angeles. So we moved to Los Angeles from New York.
How old were you?
At this point, I'm probably like 7.
Oh, wow. And what was that like? Was it scary?
I was just saying this to a friend of mine that No, I don't remember it being scary. I mean, I remember, like, I had such a strong relationship with my mom.
Yeah.
And I was so used to being around adults that I just was, you know, I was infinitely sort of adaptable.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like, when you're...
Yeah. When you're an only child, too. My daughter is an only child. I think she's so comfortable around adults.
Yeah. And there weren't a lot of babysitters, you know? Yeah. It was sort of like you
true.
Went
it's
where
so true.
You went wherever your parents were.
Yeah.
And so I was with my mom all the time. Mm-hmm. I was probably more uncomfortable in circumstances where I had to
be with a bunch of children.
With kids than I was with my mom and all of her friends. But we came to Los Angeles, and I ended up going to this very progressive school up on Mulholland called Westland that was lovely and completely like that place where you're like free to be a kid, free to be dirty, and you know, all that good stuff. I mean, it was not a traditional education in any way, shape, or form. And I definitely spent a lot of time, like, making adobe bricks and baklava and talking about my feelings. And that was good, you know? And at that point, I don't think that style was on my radar at all. Everything was going to get dirty, so there was no point in actually spending... No, I'm sorry. Towards the end of that, it was all about Esprit.
Oh, yeah.
Esprit was big.
Esprit was so big.
Yes. Yes, yes, yes. That's what I remember, for sure. And Benetton.
Benetton.
But that was also, at the time, sort of like above our pay grade.
Yeah.
So it was very aspirational. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Guess.
To be able to... Yes, 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 guess. Guess was big. The triangle so big. On your tush.
And you could pick out before school, you could like maybe get one pair of jeans when you were like, I think I'm going to do the ones like that have the pockets here, whatever it is. And you would spend the whole summer thinking about it.
Yes. But acid wash would most definitely not be like your primary pair, right?
No.
Only like if you could get an auxiliary pair, would you go for the acid wash? Otherwise, it was straight up done. But then, yeah, the little zippers on the ankles.
Yeah. When you went to Brown, did you have to get like a whole new wardrobe?
Well, that was when I sort of had like another shift in personality. So I've been like this West Coast high school California girl, right, with the baby tees and mini skirts and everything else. And then when I got into Brown, I was so excited.
Yeah.
And I was so excited to go back to the East Coast. I was so excited to be independent. In my mind, I think I actually thought I was only going to go there for a little bit because then I was going to become
a
huge movie star. That was going to happen somehow. I didn't know how. And so when I got ready to go, I remember my mom and I going shopping, and I was like, truly, it was like I was going to play a part in a movie. I would look for my like Ally McGraw inspiration of like, you know, collegiate wear and like East Coastness of it all.
I love it.
I remember getting there and being like, these girls that were real tried and true East Coasters,
right.
I was like, they wore it so easily, like that popped up collar that made me feel like I was again in a movie, but it looked so natural on them. And like just figure like the Patagonia that somehow like so seamlessly integrated into the Ralph Lauren situation that was happening. And then like there was the fringe aspect of it all, but I was very sort of like just like I went a little like retro or nostalgic. I ended up wearing a lot of like turtlenecks and those jumpers like in like a plaid that had like was like they were very fitted, and then they had like a little like little pockets in the front, and then they were short, and I wear tall boots.
Cool.
And yeah, I was very into that.
And you studied English at Brown.
I did. Well, at Brown, the great thing is you can sort of study everything.
Right.
I would never have been benefited by having to ever take one more math class. And so I did not. I took every kind of class. So I think I ended up being like maybe like one or two credits shy of having like a double concentration in art history and English because I loved art history.
Yeah.
But again, you know, I had my sights on Hollywood, so I wasn't going to need this degree that I got, Laura.
So we ask everybody before we interview them, I guess, pre-interview, who did you seek approval from the most in your career or in your life choices? And you are definitely the only person that said myself, which I think is so cool and amazing and unexpected. I mean, I'm thinking about you moving to all these different places. It all came from you.
I mean,
that's rare, just so you know.
I mean, again, if you think about, you know, having sort of like a split household and you think about moving a lot, you're sort of the constant, like wherever you are, there you are. And so it makes sense to me that I relied on myself.
Going into acting, is it something, was your family supportive or were they trying to talk you out of it?
No, they were. They were very supportive. I mean, I'm the oldest of seven. I mean, I was the kid that when I was 15, before I even had a driver's license, got a work permit so I could work at Chin Chin as a hostess, which is not like an incredibly satisfying job. But I think that I wanted it because I wanted like a piece of something that was mine.
Control over your life. Yeah.
Yeah. And I always loved working. Like I wanted to work, you know, as soon as they would let me, I loved working. Mm-hmm. I loved that responsibility. When I got out of college and I went to start acting, they were supportive in the way of like, they didn't tell me not to. Mm-hmm. I think that anybody who's in this business, if you think about the people that you love the most, which would probably be your partner and your children, it's hard to say you'd be super supportive or drive them towards it because you know how fucking hard it is.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's
so heartbreaking.
I think as parents, we end up sort of fulfilling the spot in our children's lives and their ideas of who we are. And we probably seem like nothing ever goes wrong. Everything's, you know, fantastic. And I try really hard to talk to the kids, especially the 9 and 12 year old about, I mean, just how many failures. I have been not picked so many more times than I have been picked.
Our podcast is almost always with fashion industry people. And I would love to hear a little bit about what it is like to be a young actress. I mean, what was that like?
It's thrilling. And I mean, the possibilities, right? You mean, because you're young, right? That's when everybody like smokes and drinks too much because I'm never going to die. So the possibilities are endless. I mean, I don't remember my thoughts being crowded with the idea of failure. Mm-hmm. I remember being like, I'm going to succeed. I don't know how yet. Mm-hmm. I don't know which way is going to be the right way, but I'm just going to do and think and say it all and see what happens. I do remember looking back that I definitely had a sense of self-confidence that's disproportionate with what I had going on. I didn't think and then do. I did and then thought. But I was never reckless. You know, I was just very, very driven to get what I wanted. And so when I first came out at the time, the business was super bifurcated into television and film. Mm-hmm. And actors who did film never did television.
Right.
And actors who did television were definitely considered, it was definitely a pecking order, and it was definitely on the other side, the side that you might not want to be on. You go on all these castings, and again, you don't get picked, and you don't get picked. And the first step is that you go in and you read, and at that point in your life, you're pretty much pre-reading. So the casting director has an assistant, and then you're reading for the assistant, and then if you
could pass the assistant,
then you go into the casting director, and if you pass muster, you go to see, you know, you have a session with the director. And so I remember it definitely being like baby steps, and I definitely remember celebrating the times where I was like, I made it past the pre-read, and I made it, oh my gosh, I'm going to a director session, and having that be really thrilling. I remember having to sort of figure out how to negotiate and quell nerves, because it's such a nerve-wracking sort of situation to be in. And then I remember ultimately there was this moment where I really wasn't succeeding. Like I wasn't getting the jobs. And it was because I was going out for film. And, you know, at the time it's like the independent film sort of situation had really started. So there was a lot of that. But then there was mainstream movies. And I just wasn't ever getting hired. And I was so bummed because that was not going to be my story. Because I was going to make it. And then, so that must have been like, you know, September through December, right? It was like 3 months of just like no jobs, not getting hired. And then pilot season came. And that was where, you know, television had, I mean, you were getting sent 7 scripts a day and you were going on 3 auditions a day and everything moves really fast and you're, you know, you go in and then because they want to snap up the talent, you know, you've got a test deal offer and everything's just very exciting. And that was when I sort of went from feeling like the last girl picked for the team to the first girl picked from the team. And I was like, done and done. My gosh, I'm made for TV. It's going to be amazing. Yeah. And then I just started working.
Was there a particular person that stood out, I guess, at that time as a mentor to you? Did you talk to your mom about it or were there friends that were doing the same thing?
I had friends
because it sounds so. The reason I ask is it sounds so alone, like it's lonely. Yeah, I mean, it feels lonely, right? It sounds scary and lonely.
Yeah, you have to be in a relationship. You have to have connection. You have to have purpose. And what is my purpose? And how do I design that day to feel like at the end of it I've contributed and I've connected? Mm-hmm. Because if I haven't, and when I didn't, I felt very lonely. Mm-hmm. But I had, you know, my best friend from college had moved out with me, so I had a roommate. Mm-hmm. And I remember going to a lot of acting classes, which is a mixed bag. But I was not lonely. If anything, there were times that were like, my dark times were just like wondering if it was going to ever happen.
It happened, though. And I think your most beloved role was Dr. Arizona Robbins on Grey's Anatomy. Will you talk about that? It was really significant. I mean, it was a big deal for television, actually.
Yes, it did end up being. It did. I ended up getting hired to do this David Kelly show called The Practice, mm-hmm. and that felt like my like legitimization. Like I'm actually like a real actress on a real television show that's gone for more than 12 episodes. So I ended up doing 2 seasons on that. So then the following year, my husband and I had just gotten married, and like you do, like you have your shows that you watch together and whatnot, and there's some premiere of some show on a Sunday night at 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, and it was called Grey's Anatomy. And I was like, we should watch that. We watched it and it became our show. So like every Sunday
oh,
night
really?
We watch it and we loved it. And I mean, we like double down on it.
That's
all the
so
feelings,
funny.
All the like, the, loved every character, loved every relationship, believed it all. At that time, I then went back to New York and did a couple plays, and then I came back to LA, and then I was really like trying to figure out what I was doing. Then I got pregnant, and then I did another pilot, didn't go, and my agent all the while had known that Grey's Anatomy was my favorite show. And I had Luke in September, and about 2 weeks after I had him, I get a phone call from my agent where she said, listen, I'm not pressuring you at all. I don't even think you should. But I know that you'd be so upset if I didn't tell you that they're looking to hire someone for, you know, a 3-5 episode arc on Grey's Anatomy. Do you want to go in? And I was like, yes. And so, I mean, I'm 2 weeks postpartum.
Oh, my God.
I throw on, like, 14 pairs of Spanx. I concoct an outfit. It was all about the outfit because I had to like create a waist where there was not one. There was not one to talk about or to see. So it was like a trench coat situation. And I remember thinking like, it better not be hot in there because I can't take this off. If I take this off, the whole outfit falls apart. So I went in and it was Shonda and Linda Lowy, who was the casting director. And I read it. And then I my mom watched Luke while we were there. And I went in, it was like an hour away. I mean, the whole thing like stem to stern took like 4.5 hours, and by the time I got home I was like, I did it, yes. And I get a phone call that night and they're like, they really liked you, they'd like you to come back again and do a chemistry read. And I was like, I can't do that again.
I just had a baby.
I just did that. What do you mean? Like, can you tell them just to like pull up the video or something? I don't know. So it was for a different part, and it was a part that people who know and love Grey's will remember as Nurse Rose, and it was a little romantic thing with Patrick Dempsey, who I had worked with on The Practice because he'd come to guest star. So I go back in and Patrick in all of his charm is there, and I go in with all of my like whatever I can muster.
All your estrogen.
All my estrogen, my charm, and my like
prolactin.
Pad, like my cotton pad stuffed in my bra. And it was like a great meeting, and I remember feeling like having, not to be cheesy, but like having some kind of connection with Shonda in the room. And I remember like feeling their approval, if you will. But then I got a phone call and it was like, it's not going to go your way. They hired someone else. And I was like, okay, that's fine. I was so proud of myself for just doing it.
Yeah.
So then maybe like a year later, my agent called, she's like, you know, remember how Shonda and Linda really like you, and there's another part, and, you know, here's a side, do you want to go in? I was like, of course I do. So I go in, and I get called back again, and then they call and they say, it's not going to go your way, but they really, really love you. I'm like, no, they don't. They do not love me. If they loved me, they would give me a job. So I left, but I remember them saying, like, but we really are going to find something for you. And then my agent called me maybe a couple months later and was like, you know, they're really still thinking about writing something for you. And I was like, yeah, whatever. Then out of nowhere, I get this phone call, and it's like, they would like for you to come to this 3-episode arc. That year there had been a writer's strike, which was, everybody will remember, it was a really, like, sort of scary time because people weren't working, and so, like, no one was making any money, and it was getting scary. My point is, I was just, like, infinitely grateful. I mean, I actually remember, like, sort of, like, falling to my knees grateful. I was with my mom when I got the phone call, and just so happy. And it was, again, I get to get my favorite show.
Yeah, that's so unbelievable.
I mean, I wholeheartedly threw myself into the whole thing.
And three episodes turned into 10 seasons,
which is crazy. But, yeah, so I went in, and I think, like, right around the third episode that I was in coming out, one of the producers came up to me and said, Shonda would like to talk to you. And I was like, oh my God, I'm so nervous. What do you mean? What is she going to talk to me about? I figured if I didn't make eye contact with people, like, they'd just let me stay. And so she was like wanting to talk to me. And so I went in and, hi. And she said something to the extent of, like, how do you feel about Arizona being gay? Like, how do you feel about kissing a girl? Something like that. And I was like,
sounds fun.
I'm fine with that. By the way, I've done that. And she was like, huh? I was like, yeah, I own the L word. I've kissed girls. I'm totally like, yes, that's totally in my toolkit. I have that ability to kiss girls. And so I just sort of like said that. And she was like, okay, great. And then I was sort of dismissed. And then I got out and I was like, what does that even mean? Because I think also, like, all my scenes had been with Justin Chambers, who plays Alex Karev. And so I actually thought that, because I knew that Katie Heigl was sort of transitioning out, and I didn't know anything. So there I was, and I was like, oh, okay, all right, I'm going to be gay, but, like, interesting. Who am I going to be? Like, wow, all right. It snowballed into, like, the birth of this relationship between Arizona and Cali, and then just, like, high drama and, like, beautiful scripts and relationship, and then all of a sudden it was sort of like, I remember when I... Because I was a guest star at that point, but the next season I got hired as a series regular. And I do remember someone saying, when I was doing press at that time, I think that Arizona was the only openly gay series regular character on network television.
That's extraordinary.
Which was, I didn't even notice. Again, call back to being raised by.
Yeah.
And in the generation that was like, okay, great. Like, you can do it all, right? Like,
yeah.
There's no... Like, love is love, right? And whatever it looks like is whatever it looks like.
I watched the last episode yesterday. I cried my eyes out. Oh my God, it was so sad. It's devastating.
Yeah.
And when you left, was it devastating actually?
It was. It was devastating because it was, I mean, I had been there for
a long time.
Yeah. And so there was, you know, I had 3 babies while I was there.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't, there was a permanence of Grey's Anatomy in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And a sort of cadence in which I knew what my school year looked like,
if you will.
And I think that was definitely a challenge to process.
You're also very high functioning, and I think probably having that all mapped out for 10 seasons to know I'm doing this, then I'm doing this, and then all of a sudden not having that had to be hard.
Yeah, and I think it was also that, you know, so many people, because of course when you say you have 4 kids, people go, what? 4 kids? In a way, it was easy because I knew what I was doing. I mean, I didn't know what my schedule would be, and sometimes I did work a ton, sometimes I didn't work a ton, but I knew where I was going, and I knew what I was doing, and I knew, you know, how to sort of make it all happen. And I was really good. Like, I remember one of the things that my mom said to me really early on, I did a movie and I was on location and I came back. And when you do a movie on location, you definitely, it's sort of a camp. Like, you make these really strong bonds and friendships. And then you come home and you sort of a little bit are like, where am I?
Yeah.
What am I doing? And what? And I remember being sort of super blue about it. My mom said, you know, the most important thing to remember in this job is that you have to create a life, and then you have to go off and do a job. Your job can't be your life,
right?
And you need to be able to understand the difference. And I was like, okay, great, yeah. And that I took two grays with me because I would go to work and then I would come home and I would have my life.
One of the things that we have in common, I think, is that it's really important for you and for me to show our children how much we love our work and how important work is.
Yeah.
Has that been hard?
I had my mother as a model, but I also am, I'm very curious mm-hmm. about all perspectives. And I'm very, very keen to learn from people who have done things before me.
Mm-hmm.
I'm independent in, like, I definitely will choose which way I want to do it, but I'm very dependent on and very happy to accept all advice and, you know, shortcuts. And I remember reading a book called How to Raise an Adult. And
it's a really good book. I've read it.
It's such a good book. And, you know, I always say, listen, read the whole thing. But there is, for people who are who don't have a ton of time, the first half of the book is really sort of like, how did we get here to this hyper parenting moment and model? And then the second half is like, what do we do now that we're here? There was a million important things I took away from it. But one of them was, if when you leave them, you frame it as something that's so sad and bad, like, Mama does not want to leave, but I have to go to work, then what exactly are you saying to your child?
Exactly.
Right? Like, you should accept a life in which you have to do all these things you don't want to do.
Right.
And you really love them above all else. And they're the only things that, like, yeah, make your wheel turn. No,
not good.
That does not seem
not good.
A winning proposition.
No.
So I remember really, really, like, putting that into action with my kids and being like, I love going to work. I don't always love it, but for the most part, I love what I do. And so I'm going to go to work, and you're going to be fantastic and fine and taken care of because of all the other work that I've done to make sure that you are, and that's going to be okay. So I feel like, you know, that part was actually really rewarding for me. And I remember my daughter, like, you know, towards the end when I was leaving Grays, I didn't, like, sit them all down and say, okay, so now I'm not going to go back next season, and it sort of kind of ended up, like, just jumping out, and my, at the time, 7-year-old daughter was like, wait, hold on, what's happening? And I said, well, you know, I'm not going to go back next year. And she burst into tears. Why are you crying? I mean, oh my gosh, you're so sad. Why are you so sad? And she was like, I love that you have a job, and I love that you go to work, and I'm so proud of you. And I love saying that my mom goes to work. And I mean, she had this whole
thing. Oh, I love that.
And I just sort of, like, I held her and I said, I really get that. I really do. Like, I understand that. And I'm so grateful that you feel that way. And by the way, there will be other jobs that you're super psyched that I'm doing.
Yeah.
And it's going to be really fun to figure out what those are. and she totally, you know, she got on board right away. But I it was actually, like, a perfect example of, you know, given that that's how she, you know, how we framed it.
Yeah.
That's how she feels about it.
I love that.
Yeah, it was really sweet.
I've read that you consider yourself half introvert. I think I am too.
Yeah.
How do you find alone time with 4 children and a career? and what does self-care look like for you?
Self-care for me is taking the time to be out of that for a minute. And sometimes, you know, it's like, it's a drive, it's a mm-hmm. walk, it's a hike, it can be, I don't mind being alone, you know, and
I love it.
Yeah. But the reason why I do feel like I'm half or technically an ambivert is because I also love and I'm, like, completely attracted to being in the center of a super fun party and, like, and having a great time doing that and talking to a bunch of people. But then by the end of it, I do think that I am sort of, like, ready for mm-hmm. no talking.
Have you ever done your Myers-Briggs? Do you remember Myers-Briggs?
Yeah. I did.
I wonder what you are.
I don't remember it at all. I know that it's sort of like, and I do like to think about things. It's funny because it's like, I love that I did say it and it is true, which is that I seek approval from myself. But I am also always contemplating different sides of things. Like, if I get stuck in anything, it's usually in that I care too much about all the different sides of an equation. I don't have a lot of friction in my life. Most of my relationships are quite easy, and I'm really, I'm proud of myself for being very honest and upfront. And mm-hmm. I'm not a secret keeper, and I'm not a tricky person. I'm sort of like what you see.
No drama.
You get.
You definitely are like that.
But that doesn't mean that other people won't think that I am. And I'm learning right now. I'm very fascinated by how differently we all see the world. And I don't know that I necessarily thought about that or allowed for that. So when you have that moment of all of a sudden you're like in this like interaction that feels like it's rife with friction or whatever, and you're like, I did nothing to contribute to this. What is happening right now? And you realize that it's not personal.
Yeah, it's not about you.
Someone's coming at something. It's not about you.
Yeah.
It's not about you.
That's what you really realize.
Yes. But it becomes about you in how you react to it, right?
Yes. Well, it's going to help you with having four children, because I think that the best parents are the ones that have multiple children and they're all completely different. When you realize that you allowed your children to really be themselves, I think those are great parenting families.
Yeah. It's interesting to watch.
I'm sure.
And be a part of, because, you know, I look at Luke at 12 and I think about all, you think about all that birth order psychology, and you're like, well, of course it is, because for obvious reasons to people who have parents, but I mean, who are parenting, but it's just, it's like you have this one child and it's just, it seems like your end all be all. Like, it's just, everything has to happen.
Yeah, right.
And
then you get to your fourth and you let her spray paint her hair pink and blue.
Yeah, exactly. And you're happy to. You're like, this is amazing.
This is awesome.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
What's next for you?
I think that being married to such a wonderful man and such a wonderful person has created partnership that has allowed for both of us to find our purpose, but in different ways. So there'll be times where, you know, when Christopher was creating Honest, I remember I was at Gray's, and I remember like we were creating our work and had the purpose of going to work, but we were also creating this family. And we were probably at that time more concentrated on the kids part of it, because we were younger and didn't know you actually still had to pay attention to your marriage and your partnership. And so we hit that, you know, speed bump when it came, and we all of a sudden looked at each other and we were like,
who are you?
Yeah, who are you? And like, is that different than it was 7 years ago? Is it, where are you? Like, are we going to the same place? Like, what's happening? And I do always laugh about the fact that for some reason it was like after the birth of the third child, you really know that, like, for whatever reason, like, that's the birth, like, you guys are stuck together. After three kids, I don't want to tell you, like, if you don't like it, we better fix it. But I remember just sort of feeling like my purpose and has been always to sort of like create a really, I mean, I guess, purpose for me is so split right now, I guess. And I do always talk about this when people ask me, but people always say, you know, how do you, when I say I have four kids, people always go like, how do you do it all and how do you balance it? And I always say, like, it's not a balance. It's it's on any given day, I'm a better actress than I am a mother, because I didn't show up for X, Y, or Z for my kid, but I really showed up for my job. Or I'm a better wife than I was a parent, or whatever it is. So I feel like every day my purpose shifts. I've gotten very excited about letting each day be, like, show me what my purpose is.
Yeah.
And I feel like for work, it's really about finding stories to tell that excite me. I think it's a really fascinating time for women. And I think that there's sort of this idea that women between like 35 and 65 are sort of like the ultimate consumers, but at the same time are sort of being really marginalized.
Yeah.
And so people are getting sort of hip to that, but at the same time, it's sort of, it's slow moving on some level. I feel like telling those stories, like I have a passion and a purpose when it comes to that. I've sort of been waking myself up to the idea and being convinced by others that that I can write and that I can produce.
You are an English major.
I can, exactly. And that I can do all these things.
Yeah.
Even though I haven't yet.
On every podcast, we ask what people wore to the prom, and I cannot wait to hear what you wore to the Harvard-Westlake prom. I'm so excited.
Oh, Lord. Oh, my gosh. This is really going to be a thing. Are you ready? Okay. So, I went to two.
I was going to say, I'm sure there were a couple.
I guess, actually, I think I went to three. I went, my boyfriend was a senior, and I was a sophomore, and to that one, I wore red. Really red. Norma Kamali.
Cool.
With like the bustier boning and the bra strap situation.
That is rad.
I still have it.
Ah!
That went into like a tiny little waist and then almost was like it almost looked like a dance dress. Like,
yeah.
I think it had a bodysuit in it.
That's cool.
Right? Because that's what
used to
yeah, do.
Yeah.
So there was a bodysuit in it that was like a snap crotch. And then
I love.
It was like a flare skirt. And then I wore some high heels that were like some...
Red?
No, they weren't. I think I probably wanted to get a pair and get them dyed to match exactly. But
Kathy said no.
Mom, to get Kathy was like, I'm busy with having a lot of children right now and I cannot take you to the shoemakers right now. No, I think they were like, actually, sadly, they were probably the bad part of the outfit. They were red. They were gold and black.
That's okay. That's
they were not cute. They weren't.
Okay.
Then I missed the second... I missed the second time.
Okay.
My junior year, because my family was in Poland making a movie called Schindler's List.
I've heard of it.
So I missed...
Not a lot of proms in Poland, I imagine.
Not a lot of proms
in
Poland.
Okay.
Then my senior year, and my mother must have been thinking this was to make up for... This is two proms in one. I actually wore two dresses.
You did a costume change?
No. This is the crazy part. This, like, actually... I think you're going to actually really respect this, because... I have to say, it was actually probably one of my more creative, younger styling fashion moments. So, Hervé Léger had not gone mainstream.
Right.
Like, nobody knew about it. Like, the bandage dress was, like, nobody knew about that. There was this, also, again, go back to Norma Kamali. It was a Norma Kamali shift dress. I also still have this one.
Cool.
That had sort of, like, a boat neck and was, like, a 20s design.
Pretty.
It was, like, a sheath. And it was intricately sequined.
Uh-huh.
And beaded. It wasn't shiny or reflective sequins. It was like
beautiful.
Beaded. And it kind of like had this lower, it was really short, but it was totally see-through. And so under it.
Look at you.
I wore the cream colored. It was a cream color.
That's rad.
Under it, I wore a cream colored.
Hervé Léger. Wow. Like bustier
dress.
Basic. Yeah, basically.
Yeah, and
like
so
a, how cool.
Prom, I wore that. And then for the after party, I took off the beaded part.
Oh my gosh.
But it was two dresses.
That is awesome.
And I did, and I wore it again. I remember wearing it. I wore it in college. I wore it after college.
That's
cool. It was definitely, and I think I wore some sort of strappy.
Goldy.
Something.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love it.
Yeah.
Love it. Thank you so, so much.
Oh my gosh, of course.
I loved having you. This was great.
I'm happy to be here.
Thank you.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. What We Wore is a member of the Queen City Podcast Network, powered by Ortho Carolina. Find out more at queencitypodcastnetwork.com.